Father, I praise you, I honor you, I glorify your good name. I thank you for Jesus Christ. I thank you for the presence and power of your Holy Spirit. And I ask that your Holy Spirit would be present tonight as we study your word. I pray that we'd be able to understand these prophecies, Father, and intersect our own history with them, Father. That in the end, Father, you would be glorified as we come to understand the things that are coming in the days ahead. We will give you praise in Christ's name. Amen. Okay, tonight you should have chapter 5. There's a handout. And I think you had a chapter 5 last week. This replaces that. It's had a lot of stuff added to it. And if you have your Bible, you might want to turn in your Bible to the 13th chapter of Revelation, because that's where we will be focusing tonight. Okay, tonight to me is another one of the interesting aspects of last day's prophecy, and one of the things though that's easy to do is there are so many different quote beasts in last day's prophecy. There are actually four beasts, and it's easy to get them mixed up and confused. And And so tonight, the beast that we're looking at is the second beast, and he's called the beast from the sea. What we've done in previous weeks is that we have looked at the fourth beast of Daniel 7. And the fourth beast of Daniel 7, we have interpreted that beast to be Islam. In fact, I think on the back of your handout, do you see the, says pieces of the puzzle to date? Do you have that? Okay, what we have done, what we will do through tonight, is we will have laid 20 pieces to the puzzle. And three of those pieces we're laying tonight. Most of the pieces of the puzzle we've laid through studying the fourth beast of Daniel 7. And that beast really represents what we concluded it represents Islam as a religion that wages holy war against the children of God. And however, though, that beast was Islam as of a certain period of time. We saw that it was Islam in its very beginning, when the faith was birthed, so to speak. And then we also saw in Daniel 7 that the fourth beast represented two periods of history. It represented the beginning of Islam. It represented the very end, Judgment Day. Okay, now what happens is we go to the New Testament, and we look at Revelation 13, and once again, it's a beast, but now this beast is called the beast from the sea, and as we will see in a moment, this beast has a lot of the characteristics that the beast of Daniel 7 has, and we went over those last week, and the part that we're going to look at tonight is what we just briefly touched on last week, and that's the wound to the head of the beast. So look at Revelation 13 when we'll read together, and then we'll try to apply what we're reading. He stood on the sand of the seashore, and I saw a beast coming up out of the sea. This is a beast from the sea. He has 10 horns. Okay, remember these characteristics. Remember that when the Bible gives us a characteristic, there's a reason why it's giving us that characteristic. It's to help us to identify who this beast is, because the beast is a masquerade. It's like a mask, and it doesn't identify who really is behind the mask. And so what we've got to do is we've got to look at the different criteria and different characteristics and then try to identify who this is from those characteristics. So it says, verse 1 says it had 10 horns, it had 7 heads, and on his horns, were 10 diadems. What's a diadem? Stone. It could be a crown, like a king might wear. Okay, and how many diadems do we have?
10.
How many heads do we have?
7
heads. How many horns do we have?
2.
Okay. What question should come into your mind just with the numbers? Just speak it out. Stephen? That's right. That's right. But there are only seven heads. And you got 10 horns. Well, that's what we need to notice that. See, we need to say, okay, wait a minute, something's not right here. There's 10 horns, there's seven heads, and there's 10 diadems. And so something is being communicated by those three characteristics, okay? And we'll see in a minute. Okay, then he says, and on his heads were blasphemous names. And the beast which I saw was like a leopard, and his feet were like those of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion, and the dragon gave him his power and his throne and his and great authority. So we said last week that the dragon is who? Satan. Revelation 12 tells us that the dragon is Satan, and it says that the dragon gave the beast his authority. So then the beast really is like Satan's representative. We together? It's like Satan's alter ego. We got it? We together on that? Okay. And then we said last week that the beast, based on verse 2, had three characteristics from Daniel 7. What were they? Or three animal types? The lion, the bear, and the leopard. And remember when we looked at Daniel 7, what we saw was that the text told us that the lion represented what nation? Babylon. The bear represented... who conquered Babylon? Persia. And who conquered Persia? Greece. In history. In our history, that's exactly what happened. The Persians defeated the Babylonians, and the Greeks defeated the Persians. And then who defeated the Greeks? Islam. And who else? The Romans. Okay? And Rome has generally been interpreted to be that fourth beast of Daniel 7. And which we don't agree with. We believe that fourth beast of Daniel 7 is Islam. And so this beast in the second verse has those three prior beasts. They're a part of who this beast is. You see that? Okay, this beast from the sea, it has, it says it was like a leopard, had feet like a bear, and had a mouth like a lion. And so what it's telling us is that Revelation 13, the beast that's in Revelation 13 is the same beast that was in Daniel 7. We gather on that, and this beast now absorbs those beasts. Yes, ma'am.
Lord, I would like to know how we view which animal represents
which empire. Okay. The lion is Babylon, the bear is Persia, and the leopard is Greece. Oh, Lori's afraid to ask? Come on. Okay, the point is that this beast consumes all the other nations. That's the point. Okay? Islam is the only country that has done that relative to Babylon, Persia, and Greece. They're the only country. Rome never did that. Islam consumed Rome. It consumed all of them. Okay? So what we're saying is was where we concluded last week, that Revelation 13, the beast from the sea, is Islam as a religion. Remember, we've said that none of these beasts are political empires. The difference being from a political empire and a spiritual empire would be what? What's an example of a political empire? Beg your pardon? United States. What an example of a spiritual empire would be who? Rome, Roman Catholic Church, Islam. Those are spiritual empires, okay? And we saw in Daniel, both chapter 2 and chapter 7, that the last day's beast is an empire different than Babylon, Persia, and Greece. Babylon, Persia, and Greece are all political empires. So this empire has to be something other than political. It could be economic. Okay, some interpret this to be the European Economic Community. Okay, the 10-member nation group. The problem with that is that group has never waged war against the saints. And that's one of the characteristics of Daniel 7 and Revelations 12. So in my mind, that eliminates any kind of economic empire and restricts this beast to a spiritual empire, because a spiritual empire is the only one that's going to wage war against the saints. We together on that. Okay, now let's keep moving. Verse 3, I saw one of his heads as if it had been slain, and his fatal wound was healed. The whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast, and they worshiped the dragon because he gave his authority to the beast. They worshiped the beast, saying, who is like the beast and who is able to wage war with him? There was given to him a mouth speaking arrogant words and blasphemies and authority to act. For 42 months was given to him. He opened his mouth in blasphemies against God, to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, that is, those who dwell in heaven. And it was given to him to make war with the saints. See, there's a spiritual component. It was given to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation was given to him. And all who dwell on the earth will worship him, everyone whose name has not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who has been slain. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. Okay, now, let's see. Look over at page 69. Okay, now what we saw in page 69 was, on page 69, is that the beast had how many heads? Seven heads. Had how many horns? Ten. And so either if you got, you would think that the horns would be on the heads. But since we got three horns more than heads, what that should tell us is that these are two separate identifiers for this beast. In fact, you got three separate identifiers for this beast. This beast has to have 10 horns. Something in its in the history of this empire has to have significance with a tensum. It has something that's significant with seven heads and the 10 diadems. Okay? In addition, there's one more factor that is very significant. That is verse 3 that says, I saw one of his heads as if it had been slain, and his fatal wound was healed. So the question in verse 3 is, you got seven heads, one of them is slain. And then it says the fatal wound was healed. Now, what is it that is healed? Is it the beast or the head? How do you conclude that? Okay. Okay, but it could mean, yes, Stephen? Okay, but how do you know what his refers to? In other words, it could refer, his could refer to the head. In other words, the head was wounded, and that head recovered. Okay, that could be its meaning, or it could mean there was a fatal wound to the head. One of the heads died, and when a head dies, okay.
One of the heads of the beast seemed to have had a fatal wound.
Okay. But
in the NIV translation,
right,
it's the head itself.
Okay, but look, all right, look at verse 12. Here's what verse 12 says. You can see it's very significant whether or not the head recovers or the beast recovers. And the reason why I would say that is because anytime a head is wounded, you would think that the body that the head is attached to is going to die also.
But when there's six other ones.
Well, possibly. That would certainly indicate that something's going to happen in the future, for certain.
Couldn't it be like horses?
Beg pardon?
Horses?
Like seven different forces?
Yeah.
Like what? Give me some more about that.
Okay, like, I don't know, when she just said that, all of a sudden I thought of the thing, the saying, you know,
okay. So what you're saying is that perhaps somehow there's a division being communicated?
You know, maybe an ally thing, but one of them's attacked, and then because of the other ones, they get better.
Okay, that's really good. We can go with that in a minute. That's good. Okay, let's look at verse 12. Here's what verse 12 says. And he now is another beast. This is a beast from the earth. And he, the beast from the earth, exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence. The first beast is the beast from the sea. Then it says, and he makes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast whose fatal wound was healed. So there, with Kevin's comment, that would indicate that the fatal wound that is now healed is not the wound of the head, but that first head died, that impacted the beast, it wounded the beast. And because the head dies, you would expect the beast to die also, but what it says is the beast recovered. Okay, verse 14 says, it's the same sort of idea, and he deceives those, that's the beast from the earth, he deceives those who dwell on the earth because of the signs which it was given him to perform in the presence of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who had the wound of the sword and has come to life. Notice it says the beast is the one who had the wound, as opposed to the head. Okay? So the conclusion that I am reaching is that here's what the text is saying. One of those seven heads, let's assume the heads represent kings or leaders. One of the seven dies. When it dies, the expectation is that the beast is going to die also. But the beast recovered from the wound inflicted upon itself by the death of the head, by the death of the king. Kevin? That's where we're going next. That's who I think it is. That beast, the head that has died is Muhammad. And the reason why we make that conclusion is this. Okay, if you look on page 70. Okay, here's what happened when Muhammad died. Muhammad died when Islam was only 10 years old. All that Muhammad had done in that 10-year period of time is he had basically brought the Bedouin tribes of Saudi Arabia together. Those desert tribes were tribes, they were clans, families, and they were always at war against one another. Throughout their entire history, they were desert warriors, and if one clan member would look at the clan member of another tribe, you know, with a funny look, the war would break out. I mean, it was just unbelievable. The Bedouin tribes, that's what they were known for, is they were known for bloodshed and constant conflicts. And what Muhammad did that was astounding was somehow he brought all of these Arabian desert warriors, these nomads, together under one religion, under one leader. And they all followed Muhammad. And I mean, that's what Muhammad did. Then he, right at the height, right when you would say Islam is ready to advance outside of Saudi Arabia, Muhammad dies. You know, he complains of a headache. And in 2 weeks, he's dead. And he had not named a successor. We've talked about that before. And so what happens is, Islam is faced with two crises. The first one is they got to figure out who is going to take Muhammad's place. And remember, the significance of Muhammad was one who received the revelation of the Quran. Okay? So you can't just have anybody step in the shoes of Muhammad, and no matter who it is, they're not going to continue to receive any revelations of the Quran. So the person already had three strikes against them, whoever the successor was going to be. And so they had that problem, and then what happened was that the Bedouin tribes would desert the Islamic kingdom once Muhammad was dead, because Muhammad, it's like they had a contract, an agreement with Muhammad, and when Muhammad died, the agreement was over. You got it? So the expectation is that Islam should have disappeared as a religion when Muhammad died. Kevin?
They still have wars between the tribes.
Yeah. Yeah, they do. Tribes and sects. S-E-C-T-S. They do. Yes, that's correct. Mm-hmm. Okay. Here's what happened. As we have just thought, suggested, the Bedouin tribes left when Muhammad died. Abu Bakr was the first caliph. He was the one that was appointed the successor to Muhammad. it was his job, his first job, was to bring the apostates back under Islamic unity. The Ridda Wars, R-I-D-D-A. Ridda stands for apostate. And so the Ridda Wars were the wars of that would bring the apostates back under Islam. And Abu Bakr was the one, the caliph, who led those in those wars. And here's what happened. By accident, literally by accident, what happened was that the Islamic, some of the Islamic warriors went outside of Arabia to get booty for subsistence. And they went into Syria and went into Iraq, not to try to conquer Iraq, not to try to conquer Syria. They went there for booty. Well, lo and behold, they won every single battle. And so what happens is that the apostates, when they see the success that is being realized by Islam under Abu Bakr, what they do is they come back under the Ummah, the community of Islam, because they want the prosperity of booty. Okay? And so what happens is, in the very midst of Islam's doom, it's absolutely resurrected by successful conquest into Iraq and into Syria. Okay? That's what's talked about on page 71. And that's what revives Islam. There's a quote there from Karen Armstrong in the very middle of the page that you can read that describes how they end up going into Syria. In 636, they conquer the Syrians. 638, Jerusalem is handed to them on a silver platter. Egypt in 641. And so it's like these nations fall into their lap. And Islam becomes the greatest conquering nation in the world at that time, almost by accident. Abu Bakr dies 2 years after he's caliph. He's followed by Umar. Umar lasts 10 years, and the conquest continues. And then he's followed by Uthman for 10 years. Each one of them, it's like everybody falls over dead all around them, all the nations around them, and they are the successful conquerors, and Islam is revived. Okay, now, there's not any other identifier about that head. And if you think about it, it makes perfect sense. Here's the reason. Other than the revelation of the Quran and Muhammad uniting the Bedouin tribes, there was nothing significant about Muhammad. Nothing. For 10 years, that's all he led, Islam. And the second largest religion in the world is now Islam. It almost doesn't make any sense. You know, you look at the text, and all the text says is one of the heads was slain, the beast recovered. That's all it says. That pretty much explains Muhammad. Okay? And that's all we've got to go on who that head might be. So what I would do, what I have done, is this. I'd say, okay, it sounds like that might be Muhammad. But let's just not make a conclusion. And this is this idea about the pieces of the puzzle. Okay, it's like this. See, here's what I've done. It's like, suppose I was trying to identify for you someone you've never seen before. Okay? And suppose you're going to the airport, and I said, here's a person you need to look for. You know, they're about 6 feet tall. They got blonde hair, they have blue eyes, they weigh about 150 pounds, and they walk with a limp. What you would do is you take all those characteristics that I just gave you, and you'd look for someone like that in the crowd. Okay? And then, when you thought you found them, you'd go ask them, hey, you know, is this who I'm looking for? Is this you? Well, that's sort of what I'm doing here. We got all these identifiers, and what we got to do is take one identifier and figure out who meets this one. Look at the next one and the next one and the next one. Okay, here's the next one. The second identifier is what we find in that second verse. In the first verse, it says it has seven heads. Okay, if we say that Muhammad is the first head that was slain, then we would say that the seven heads have some type of function similar to what Muhammad had. Muhammad was the leader of Islam. So then let's suppose what we look for is seven leaders and see if the pieces fit. Okay, on page 72, here's what I've given you. You know, on page 72 and 73, that little table is a table, and each one of the headings is a separate caliphate of Islam, a separate clan of Islam that rules from the time of Muhammad to the present day. What that seventh table represents is 1,300 years of Islamic rule. Okay, did y'all get that? Okay, let me say that. Let me show it to you. Okay, the first one, let's assume that these seven heads are represented in this table. The first head is Muhammad and the first four caliphs of Islam, the rightly guided caliphs. The rightly guided caliphs, these four caliphs were never really like accepted by both Sunni and Shiite sects, but as a group, they're always considered together as one group. Okay? So consider that as your first grouping. If you look in history books, the first dynasty of Islam is called the Umayyad dynasty. It begins in the year 661 under the Caliph Muawiyah I. The Umayyads were in control in Islam from the year 661 through the year 749. Johnny, your mommy just left. Is she looking for you?
No.
Or what are you doing in here? She told you to come in here? Okay, well, just sit on that back row then, okay? Okay. Okay, so the first empire, according to historians, are the Umayyads. And they reign, the Umayyads are a family or a clan. And they reign the capital is in Syria. They reign for about 150 years. Well, whatever that is, 100 years, 80 years. Okay, then the next dynasty is the Abbasids. The Abbasids defeat the Umayyads in 749, and they rule till 932. Okay, these are clans, okay? They're separate clans. You know, you talk about the Hatfields and the McCoys, so to speak. You got the Umayyads, and then you have the Abbasids. The next empire is the Buyids, ruling from 932 to 1055. They rule out of Baghdad. Okay, that's where the caliphate was headquartered under the Buyids. To the west of there is a competing caliphate called the Fatimids, and they rule in Egypt. The Fatimids and the Buyids they rule at the same time. They are in opposition to one another, and each one claims to be the true caliphate for that period of time. Just one rules in Egypt and one rules in Baghdad. The fifth empire is the Seljuk Turks and the Ayyubids. The Seljuk Turks rule out of Baghdad and the Ayyubids rule out of Egypt. Turn the page. The sixth empire is the Mongols. Or are the Mongols. They rule from Baghdad. The Mamluks rule from Egypt at the same period of time. The seventh empire are the Ottomans. The Ottomans rule from 1342 through 1924. Yes, Kevin. Well, you mean a political empire?
Yes.
Not particularly, no.
And
the reason why I did not look at it as a political empire is because everything in the last days prophecy speaks of spiritual empires as opposed to political. And so my natural inclination would be not to look at a country, but to look at a spiritual empire. And the thing that's interesting is that these seven caliphates are all Islamic reigns. They're all Islamic dynasties. As opposed to, even though the caliphate may be in Baghdad, it was not an Iraqi empire. Or in Egypt, it was not, you know, an Egyptian empire. It was always an Islamic empire with a caliph over here in Egypt or a caliph over here in Baghdad, and both of them are trying to convince everybody else that they're caliph, that they're top dog. And what they end up doing at times in history is they agree just to reign separately. Kevin? The reason why I'm lumping them together is because they reign at the same time. Pretty much the same periods of time. In other words, the Fourth Empire in Baghdad competes against the Fourth Empire in Egypt. In other words, if you look at these seven caliphates, we're almost like saying there's seven successive periods of time or eras. And within each era, a caliph rules in Egypt and a caliph rules in Baghdad. And that's still one era. You follow what I'm saying? Right, it's so far as Islam goes. See, the third, fourth, and fifth empires or periods, we have a dual reign in those two. In the other empires, the first, second, third, and seventh, we have singular reign. And basically, this table was completed and then I counted. You understand what I'm saying? Okay, Kate. This is an original table that I made. This is not out of a book somewhere. Yeah, if you look at the footnotes on page, starting on page 75, okay, here's what you've got in the footnotes. I decided not to put that in the body of the text because not everybody's a history buff. And not everybody would want a short paragraph on, for example, the Umayyads, the Abbasids, the Buyids, and so forth. But what you've got is with each separate clan or dynasty, you've got a short bullet point of the history of how that clan came to be, who was its first leader, and how, you know, what was significant about it in terms of history. They're like three primary sources that I consulted for each one of these different groupings. And, you know, it might be some late night reading for you, help you go to sleep. But to me, I just think about it.
So that's where you get the seven heads and ten crowns?
I hadn't got to the ten crowns yet. We'll come to that next. Okay? But what we've got is seven heads. Think about it. If Muhammad's the first, then it tracks that the other six would be exactly as I've got them outlined. Now, what we have to also do, though, is even though I have three of them with dual caliphs, somehow in the criteria, we got to recognize the fact that we got more caliphs and we got seven periods. Count them. There's 10. You see? You got 10 diadems. Count them. There are 10 caliphs. 10 caliphate empires, even if you consider, when you consider the competing caliphs, the number comes to 10. Okay, we might disregard the 7 if we couldn't hit the 10. But when we hit the 7 and we hit the 10, that when I saw that, I went, ooh, wow. Do you see what I'm saying here? Does that make sense, what we're saying? Mm-hmm. No, that's not correct. No. I mean, anybody who would study Islamic history would come up with the same table. It's just I didn't copy it from someone.
I mean, that's why it's not existent out there. I mean, all of the histories of these different dynasties are out there, but it's not presented in these seven.
In these seven periods, that's right. But if you, in other words, if you went through... Well, here's what an Islamic historian could question. An Islamic historian could not question whether or not the Umayyads were the first dynasty. They couldn't question whether the Abbasids were the next one. They couldn't question whether or not the Buyids and the Fatimids were against one another, one in Baghdad and one in other words, the facts are there. Now, how you line them up in a table, you count them as 10 separate caliphates, or you count them as 7 with a possible combination of 10. In other words, just like, for example, we might look at a car. We might describe a car in the parking lot. I might say, okay, it's a SUV. It's white. It's got, you know, 4 doors, and it's, 2001 model. And those would be the facts about that car. Well, you might look at it, and you might describe them in a different order. But you still would have the same facts about the car. In other words, what I have done is I've just read Islamic history. And I've come up with these separate categories. Not even, for example, the caliphs. I mean, like the Umayyads. I mean... You can go look at Wikipedia tonight. See what you see about the Umayyads. You'll see they're the very first dynasty. Yeah.
I mean, I've read most of those histories, but I've never seen this table. That's why I'm very, very interested in the presentation.
Well, you wouldn't have seen the table. Well, I don't know about this. I just know that I had to try to figure out the history. And in fact, when I saw the seven successive, when I first came across the interpretation that the seven heads might be seven successive Islamic empires, it wasn't from the standpoint of it being Islam. One of the commentaries that I use on Revelation said maybe what the seven heads are seven successive kingdoms in some period of time. So what I did was I said, whoa, that might fit. And so when I first did my table, I just wrote down these names. And I came up with 9. And the reason, see, was because I was I found out yesterday that the Buyids and the Fatimids reigned at the same time. So did the Seljuks and the Ayyubids. You know, they reigned at the same time. And so what I found out yesterday was that we really have 7 dynasties, if you count Muhammad as the first.
Said another way, whether you trace the Islamic line through Egypt versus through Baghdad, you get 7 successive empires.
Right.
When you combine the two, you get 10 crowns.
You get 10 crowns. That's right. Right. Yes, Bob.
How do you account for after 1924 and beyond?
Okay, that's a really good question because that was a concern to me as well. Well, after the Ottomans, there is no caliphate. Ataturk, who in 1924 was a president of Turkey, did away with the... Quran as the governing document for Turkey. Replaced it with a republic. And basically a democracy. So even though Turkey still remained an Islamic country, okay, Turkey today is predominantly Muslim, but it's not governed by Sharia, Islamic law, like Saudi Arabia is and Iran. It's governed by a constitution like the United States of America. And so basically, after the Ottomans, there is no caliphate right now. There is none. You know, it's really interesting because what's going to happen? Okay, what we have done as of tonight is we finished with the past. We finished with all of the past relative to Islam. The next beast that we look at is future, is current time, is present tense and future. Yeah, that's. I actually have that in the footnote. It's in the footnote. That's the end of the time. That's it. So, yes, Kevin?
Just so I understand again. Talking about the seven heads and then the ten
beards. Okay, let me back up 1 second. Remember that the ten horns, who do the ten horns represent? Ten companions. Okay, what we said a few weeks ago, we said this, that they're like, every one of these beasts have ten horns. And so what we said was that Muhammad had ten companions when he was alive. These ten companions were called the Blessed Ten and so forth and so on. They functioned in the role the same role that disciples had of Jesus Christ, except the companions, after Muhammad's death, had much more power, and four of them became the first four caliphs. But they, anytime you see the ten horns, think, okay, this is probably the companions, and they sort of act as like a general identifier of the religion itself. Okay, so in this Revelation 13, these ten horns, they really represent Islam as a religion as manifested by the ten companions, or demonstrated by the ten companions' presence. So then we go to the ten diadems, and they're the new part in Revelation 13 that was not in Daniel 7. Okay, now go ahead. Right. Well, each particular horn. See, this is what you got to do. You got to separate the horns from the heads. Okay? They're two separate criteria. We could say, instead of calling it ten horns, call it ten tails. And instead of seven heads, say it's seven ears. Wouldn't matter. The body part is not the significance. The fact is that what we got to do is find some empire where 10 has dual significance. 10 horns, 10 diadems. And 7 has significance as well. In addition, if you think about it, what we're trying to do when we go to Revelation 13 is Revelation 13 is not just talking about Islam in the very last day of time, last period of time. What the text has got to tell us, it's got to demonstrate who this empire is throughout human history. And so if you think about it from that perspective, that's why the commentary that I looked at said that perhaps what this is seven successive empires. Because what the text is showing us is we're not talking about 100 years here. You know, we're talking about a couple thousand years. And so over this couple thousand year period of time, the text has got to tell us something to be able to identify this particular kingdom from any other kingdom. That's what it's trying to do. And the good news is we got 10 horns, we got 10 diadems, and we got 7 heads. In other words, you got 3 separate identifiers that have to be met before we can say, hey, this is him. This is the beast.
The Ten Commandments Yeah.
You said that they had more power than the disciples. What type of power did they have?
Power in the sense of military power.
Military.
Yeah. The disciples, all they did, the only power they had was spiritual. They were told to go evangelize the world. The ten companions were told to go Islamicize the world with their sword. A little different kind of sword. Right, but yeah, these guys didn't have healing power, they just had cutting power.
Along the same lines, the seven empires, were they all taken over through by violence? Was it all?
No. Most of them were. Let me back up a minute. Let's see. No, they were all by violence. The hesitation comes because, for example, go to the Mongols. Okay, you know, before I did this research, I never thought of Mongols as Islamic. What happened with the Mongols is under Genghis Khan, you know, they were Shintoist, which basically means that, you know, nature is God, and they accepted everybody's religion. Well, what happens, the Mongols conquer the Balkans, and then they start heading down into Persia, excuse me, and adopt the Islamic religion. So, and so what they did is the Mongols conquered Islam and became Muslim. That's what happened with the Mongols. They were not Islamics going to conquer the world in the name of Islam. It was the other way around. But all the same, they still conquered the caliphates in Syria, I think. Or no, not Syria. Yeah, Baghdad. Baghdad and Egypt. No, not Egypt. Baghdad. Just Baghdad. Okay. Yes, ma'am? Good question. The reason is just because the term was different in just depending upon who was in charge. The caliph, the term caliph, disappeared for a good period of time, beginning with the Buyids, and as far as Baghdad is concerned, if you look for Baghdad, you have emirs in the fourth, you have sultans in the fifth, sultans in the sixth, and sultans in the seventh. And the Ottomans used the term caliph in like the 19th century, but they used it really for more political purposes to try to reunite Islam. But it was, you know, the term sort of has the same kind of meaning, but caliph is primarily an Arabian term, and the other terms are like Persian terms, Turkish terms. Kevin?
Like we're now in Iran, you have emirs, in Baghdad, in Iraq, you have still caliphs.
I don't even think you have caliphs, even in Iraq now. I don't think that term is used now in modern day. Al-Sadr is not, he doesn't call himself caliph. Okay, Jen?
I'm a visual kind of person, so I was kind of drawn about the seven heads and the ten horns and the ten diadems. And then I was thinking about the statue.
Yeah.
I was thinking of the person, I can't remember what that was.
Mm-hmm.
One, can you refresh my memory on that? And
okay. Yeah.
And on verse 12 it says, the ten horns which you saw are ten kings.
Okay. Yeah, but see, that's the scarlet beast, though.
Oh, okay.
That's the future beast.
That's a what?
That's a future beast.
Oh, okay.
See, remember what I said earlier? What I said was, this is the last beast of the past that we will deal with. The scarlet beast is a future beast. The beast from the earth, I think, is also a future beast. Now, you said to refresh your memory on the statue. Here's where I remember the statue. The statue had a head of gold. It had breastplate of silver, feet and legs of iron, toes partly clay and partly of iron. And that was it represented the four empires. Babylon was a head of gold. Persia was the breastplate of silver. And Greece were the legs, I think it was, and then the feet of iron and clay is the fourth empire. No, that's interpreter's view. That my view is it's Islam. Okay, Holly. Go, that's fine. Yeah, right. Diadems. Mm-hmm. The diadems are on the horns. Yeah, you can't do that because you got 10 horns and 7 heads. Yeah, but the thing about it is you've introduced something subjective. Okay. Okay. Right. Right. Yeah. I don't see what you're saying. I mean, I see we got 10 horns, 7 heads. See, and then it's got, huh?
All the horns have to do with one head.
Well, all the horns have to do with the beast, not a head. Yeah, but the head number one, that's right. But the horns, remember what happens is Muhammad dies. The horns represent Islam. I mean, they are the companions that take over, led by a new caliph. Yeah, but it doesn't say the horns are on the heads. It says the horns are on the beast. Right. Yeah, right. Right. No. Well, I can see why you would think that the diadems would be on the heads, the way I've got it figured out. I can see that, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that may be another view, it may be another interpretation. But I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. Okay, Bob?
If you take 3 times that there were 2 caliphs.
Yeah, speak up.
3 times that there were 2 caliphs.
Right.
And then the other 7. And on 3 of those, you put 2, you come up with 10.
That would do it. That would do it. Mm-hmm. Yep, that would be how you would place them.
The 3 times when there's 2 caliphs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's 7 heads. So for each time that there's a 2 caliphs,
it's got 2 heads. That's right. That would be how you would illustrate it. Mm-hmm. That's good.
Mm-hmm.
Does that help, Holly? Because Bob's way would answer your question. Okay, Dick.
Where you have dual caliphs,
mm-hmm. No, not necessarily. Nope. Remember, the Shiites were the weaker sect, and they were in hiding. The only Shiite group in that whole group, I'm pretty sure, are the Buyids. The Buyids were Shiite.
And didn't they call themselves Imams?
No. You're thinking of the Ismailis. The Ismailis were the Fatimids. Okay, Melissa? Yeah, right.
They also became part of the first.
No. No, they're just like always there. They're always in the background. Yeah. It's like different dimensions. That would be a way to put it. It's like, you know, the companions say, this is Islam. The ten horns. They're always present. Now it's going to change in the future period. In the future beast, the scarlet beast, those ten horns are going to have a different meaning. But in Revelations 12, in Revelations 13, in Daniel 7, it's always ten horns, which I have interpreted to be the ten companions a race, or, you know, it's like some characteristics that says, this is Islam. It's like an identifier.
American flag,
yeah. David? Did that answer your question or not? Because I can't do any better. In other words, you know, I know that the ten horns, you know, I don't have a lot to hang my hat on with that, other than the fact that I had their ten companions. And in Daniel 7, when Daniel 7 is the the first picture we have of Islam, since we're looking at Islam at that point in time as the beginning of that religion. It's easier to see ten companions in Daniel 7, because Daniel 7 is painting the beginning of Islam, than it is in Revelation 13, because Revelation 13 is painting the beginning and the middle, all the way up until the future days. Okay, David?
So in this table 72, are you saying that the first column would be the heads?
Yes.
So if you could put the head in that first column?
Yeah, in fact, really, if I had to do it over again, I would put, for Umayyads, I'd say first dynasty or first empire. You see what I'm saying? But the left column really are the heads.
Okay.
Those are the heads of the beast. And then the first empire, where the Umayyads, where I have second, I think it would be a better way to put it would be to say that would be the first, because it is the first empire of Islam, the Umayyads are. And the reason why I call it two is because I'm now thinking of heads in my next column over.
That squares with the previous paragraph where it says the seven heads of the beast.
Yes.
Which head you're talking about.
Yeah, right. Okay, any other questions? Okay, Dick?
Yeah, this is kind of a little off, but I was wondering if you could clarify Revelations 13, 7 through 10.
Okay, 7 through 10. It was given to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them, and authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation was given to him, and all who dwell on the earth will worship him. Everyone whose name has not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who has been slain. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is destined for captivity, to captivity he goes. If anyone kills with a sword he must be killed. Here is the perseverance and faith of the saints. I think verse 7, there are two views. I would have two views. Number one would be that verse 7 through 10 is talking about the period when Islam conquered Christendom. It would be the 7th through the 15th centuries. Okay, that would be the first view. Because it says, it was given to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And that's exactly what happened, you know, throughout all the Middle East, Palestine, Syria, Turkey, Christian, those were Christian countries, and they were overcome. So hopefully, verses 7 through 10 have already been fulfilled relative to you and I.
But 8 says, all inhabitants of the earth will worship the beast.
Everyone whose name has not been written.
They didn't conquer the whole world
mm-hmm.
at that time.
That's true. That's true. So, that would lead us to the second interpretation, which would be that verses 7 through 10 are a future period.
Which you could interpret that one day the world would be totally Islam.
That's right. Everyone would be Islamic except those whose names are in the Lamb's Book of Life, those who are believers in Jesus Christ. Well, it doesn't say that they would be dead. It just said they would be overcome. So that does not necessarily mean death. Okay, David?
Could it also be that it was already fulfilled, but since it says will, and it's talking about the beast, it's talking about a future time. You know, in other words, it did happen in the past. You know, it did conquer, but
relative to the writing of Revelation 13, it was future.
Yeah.
Relative to us, it's past. That's our hope and prayer. Okay? Okay, now, next Wednesday, you need to pray for me because I have to do the part that is much harder, I think, is the future stuff. And although I've already done a first draft of that, it's been a long time since I've gone to it, but we'll look at start with Revelation 17. I think we'll start with that next week. If we don't, it'll be because I'm just not finished. Okay, let's stand and close with prayer. Father, I praise your name and I glorify your name. I thank you for Jesus Christ. I thank you for your grace and your mercy that we experience through Jesus Christ. I pray your blessings on each one of us as we go our separate ways. I ask you to loose your spirit among us, God, and we'll give you praise. In Christ's name, amen. Okay, if you do not...